in all actions and relations whatsoever, beginning at this instant. This in turn depends upon seeing that you have really no choice but to be aware, because you cannot separate yourself from the present, and you cannot define it. You can, indeed, refuse to admit this, but only at the cost of the immense and futile effort of spending your whole life resisting the inevitable. Once this is understood, it is really absurd to say that there is a choice, or an alternative, between these two ways of life, between resisting the stream in fruitless panic and having one's eyes opened to a new world, transformed and ever new with wonder. The key is understanding. To ask how to do this, what is the technique or method, what are the steps and rules, is to miss the point utterly. Methods are for creating things which do not yet exist. We are concerned here with understanding something which is the present moment. This is not a psychological or spiritual discipline for self-improvement. It is simply being aware of this present experience and realizing that you can neither define it nor divide yourself from it. There is no rule but look. It is no mere poetic sentiment to say that, with the mind thus opened, we look into a new world, as new as on the first day of creation, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. By trying to understand everything in terms of memory, the past, and words, we have, as it were, had our noses in the guidebook for most of our lives, and have never looked at the view. Whitehead's criticism of traditional education is applicable to our whole way of living. We are too exclusively bookish in our scholastic routine. In the Garden of Eden, Adam saw the animals before he named them. In the traditional system, children named the animals before they saw them. In the widest sense of the word, to name is to interpret experience by the past, to translate it into terms of memory, to bind the unknown into the system of the known. Civilized man knows of hardly any other way of understanding things. Everybody, everything, has to have its label, its number, certificate, registration, classification. What is not classified is irregular, unpredictable, and dangerous. Without passport, birth certificate, or membership in some nation, one's existence is not recognized. If you do not agree with the capitalists, they call you a communist, and vice versa. A person who agrees with neither point of view is fast becoming unintelligible. That there is a way of looking at life apart from all conceptions, beliefs, opinions, and theories is the remotest of all possibilities from the modern mind. If such a point of view exists, it can only be in the vacant brain of a moron. We suffer from the delusion that the entire universe is held in order by the categories of human thought, fearing that if we do not hold to them with the utmost tenacity, everything will vanish into chaos. We must repeat. Memory, thought, language, and logic are essential to human life. They are one half of sanity. But a person, a society, which is only half sane, is insane. To look at life without words is not to lose the ability to form words, to think, remember, and plan. To be silent is not to lose your tongue. On the contrary, it is only through silence that one can discover something new to talk about. One who talked incessantly, without stopping to look and listen, would repeat himself ad nauseam. It is the same with thinking, which is really silent talking. It is not, by itself, open to the discovery of anything new, for its only novelties are simply rearrangements of old words and ideas. There was a time when language was constantly being enriched by new words, a time when men, like Adam, saw things before they named them. Today, almost all new words are rearrangements of old words, for we are no longer thinking creatively. By this I do not mean that we ought all to be popping with inventions and revolutionary discoveries. This is the always rare power of those who can both see the unknown and interpret it. For most of us, the other half of sanity lies simply in seeing and enjoying the unknown, just as we can enjoy music without knowing either how it is written or how the body hears it. Certainly the revolutionary thinker must go beyond thought. He knows that almost all his best ideas came to him when thinking has stopped. He may have struggled and struggled to understand a problem in terms of old ways of thinking, only to find it impossible. But when thought stops from exhaustion, the mind is open to see the problem as it is, not as it is verbalized, and at once it is understood. But going beyond thought is not reserved to men of genius. It is open to all of us insofar as the mystery of life is not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be experienced. It is given to many to be seers, but to few to be prophets. Many can listen to music, but few can perform and compose. But you cannot even listen if you can hear only in terms of the past. What should we make of one of Mozart's symphonies if our ears were attuned only to the music of tom-toms? We might get the rhythms, but almost nothing of the harmony and melody. In other words, we should fail to discover an essential element of the music. To be able to hear, much less write, such a symphony, men had to discover new noises, the vibrations of catgut, the sound of air in a tube, and the hum of a plucked wire. They had to discover the whole world of tone as something entirely different from pulse. If I can only conceive pulse, I cannot appreciate tone. If I can think of painting only as a way of making colored photographs without a camera, I can see nothing but ineptitude in a Chinese landscape. We learn nothing of very much importance when it can be explained entirely in terms of past experience. If it were possible to understand all things in terms of what we know already, we could convey the sense of color to a blind man with nothing but sound, taste, touch, and smell. If this is true in the various arts and sciences, it is 1,000 times more true when we come to the understanding of life in a larger sense and want to have some knowledge of the ultimate reality, or God. It is surely absurd to seek God in terms of a preconceived idea of what God is. To seek thus is only to find what we know already, which is why it is so easy to deceive oneself into all manner of supernatural experiences and visions. To believe in God and to look for the God you believe in is simply to seek confirmation of an opinion. To ask for a revelation of God's will, and then to test it by reference to your preconceived moral standards, is to make a mockery of asking. You knew the answer already. Seeking for God, in this way, is no more than asking for the stamp of absolute authority and certainty on what you believe in any case, for a guarantee that the unknown and the future will be a continuation of what you want to retain from the past, a bigger and better fortress for I. Ein feste Burg. If we are open only to discoveries which will accord with what we know already, we may as well stay shut. This is why the marvelous achievements of science and technology are of so little real use to us. It is in vain that we can predict and control the course of events in the future unless we know how to live in the present. It is in vain that doctors prolong life if we spend the extra time being anxious to live still longer. It is in vain that engineers devise faster and easier means of travel if the new sights that we see are merely sorted and understood in terms of old prejudices. It is in vain that we get the power of the atom if we are just to continue in the rut of blowing people up. Tools such as these, as well as the tools of language and thought, are of real use to men only if they are awake, not lost in the dreamland of past and future, but in the closest touch with that point of experience where reality can alone be discovered, this moment. Here life is alive, vibrant, vivid, and present, containing depths which we have hardly begun to explore. But to see and understand it at all, the mind must not be divided into I and this experience. The moment must be what it always is, all that you are and all that you know. In this house, there is no room for thee and me.
7. The Transformation of Life. The white man fancies himself as a practical person who wants to get results. He is impatient with theory and with any discussion which does not immediately get down to concrete applications. This is why the behavior of Western civilization might be described in general as much ado about nothing. The proper meaning of theory is not idle speculation, but vision. And it was rightly said that where there is no vision, the people perish. But vision in this sense does not mean dreams and ideals for the future. It means understanding of life as it is, of what we are, and what we are doing. Without such understanding, it is simply ridiculous to talk of being practical and getting results. It is like walking busily in a fog. You just go round and round. You do not know where you are going, nor what results you really want. To minds that think in this way, what we have discussed so far may seem too theoretical. These ideas are all very well, but do they work? Yet, I must ask, what do you mean by work? The usual working test of a philosophy is whether it makes people better and happier, whether it results in peace, cooperation, and prosperity. Yet this is a meaningless criterion without much theoretical understanding. What do you mean by happiness? What are better people better for? About what will you cooperate? What will you do with peace and prosperity? The answer to these questions depends entirely on what we are and what we actually want now. If, for example, we want, at the same time, both peace and isolation, brotherhood and security for I, happiness and permanence, our wants are contradictory. Their results, however practical we may be about getting them, will be further contradictions. It is the old story of wanting to have your cake and eat it, to which the only possible conclusion is that you put it in your stomach and keep it there until you have violent indigestion. If we must be nationalists and have a sovereign state, we cannot also expect to have world peace. If we want to get everything at the lowest possible cost, we cannot expect to get the best possible quality, the balance between the two being mediocrity. If we make it an ideal to be morally superior, we cannot at the same time avoid self-righteousness. If we cling to belief in God, we cannot likewise have faith, since faith is not clinging, but letting go. When we have made up our minds as to what we do want, there remain, indeed, many practical and technical problems. But there is no point at all in discussing these until we have made up our minds. There is, in turn, no possibility of making up our minds so long as they are split in two, so long as I am one thing and experience another. If the mind is the directive force behind action, the mind and its vision of life must be healed before action can be anything but conflict. Something must therefore be said about the healed vision of life which comes with full awareness, for it involves a deep transformation of our view of the world. As well as words can describe it, this transformation consists in knowing and feeling that the world is an organic unity. In the ordinary way, we know this as a matter of information, but do not feel it to be true. Certainly, most people feel separate from everything that surrounds them. On the one hand, there is myself, and on the other, the rest of the universe. I am not rooted in the earth like a tree. I rattle around independently. I seem to be the center of everything, and yet cut off and alone. I can feel what is going on inside my own body, but I can only guess what is going on in others. My conscious mind must have its roots and origins in the most unfathomable depths of being, yet it feels as if it lived all by itself in this tight little skull. Nevertheless, the physical reality is that my body exists only in relation to this universe. And in fact, I am as attached to it and dependent on it as a leaf on a tree. I feel cut off only because I am split within myself, because I try to be divided from my own feelings and sensations. What I feel and sense, therefore, seems foreign to me. And on being aware of the unreality of this division, the universe does not seem foreign anymore. For I am what I know. What I know is I. The sensation of a house across the street, or of a star in outer space, is no less I than an itch on the sole of my foot, or an idea in my brain. In another sense, I am also what I do not know. I am not aware of my own brain as a brain. In just the same way, I am not aware of the house across the street as a thing apart from my sensation of it. I know my brain as thoughts and feelings, and I know the house as sensations. In the same way and sense that I do not know my own brain, or the house as a thing in itself, I do not know the private thoughts in your brain. But my brain which is also I, your brain and the thoughts within it, as well as the house across the street, are all forms of an inextricably interwoven process called the real world. Conscious or unconscious of it as I may be, it is all I in the sense that the sun, the air, and human society are just as vital to me as my brain or my lungs. If, then, this brain is my brain, unaware of it as I am, the sun is my sun, the air my air, and society my society. Certainly, I cannot command the sun to be egg-shaped, nor force your brain to think differently. I cannot see the inside of the sun, nor can I share your private feelings. Yet neither can I change the shape or structure of my own brain, nor have a sensation of it as a contraption like a cauliflower. But if my brain is, nonetheless, I, the sun is I, the air is I, and society, of which you are a member, is also I. For all these things are just as essential to my existence as my brain. That there is a sun, apart from my sensation of it, is an inference. The fact that I have a brain, though I cannot see it, is likewise an inference. We know about these things only in theory, and not by immediate experience. But this external world of theoretical objects is, apparently, just as much a unity as the internal world of experience. From experience, I infer that it exists, and because experience is a unity, I am my sensations, I must likewise infer that this theoretical universe is a unity, that my body and the world form a single process. Now, there have been many theories about the unity of the universe, but they have not delivered human beings from the isolation of egotism, from conflict, and from the fear of life. Because there is a world of difference between an inference and a feeling. You can reason that the universe is a unity without feeling it to be so. You can establish the theory that your body is a movement in an unbroken process which includes all suns and stars, and yet continue to feel separate and lonely. For the feeling will not correspond to the theory until you have also discovered the unity of inner experience. Despite all theories, you will feel that you are isolated from life so long as you are divided within. But you will cease to feel isolated when you recognize, for example, that you do not have a sensation of the sky. You are that sensation. For all purposes of feeling, your sensation of the sky is the sky, and there is no you apart from what you sense, feel, and know. This is why the mystics and many of the poets give frequent utterance to the feeling that they are one with the all, or united with God, or as Sir Edwin Arnold expressed it, "Forgoing self, the universe grows I." Sometimes, indeed, this feeling is purely sentimental, the poet being one with nature just so long as she is on her best behavior. I live not in myself, but I become portion of that around me, and to me high mountains are a feeling. But the hum of human cities, torture. I can see nothing to loathe in nature, save to be a link reluctant in a fleshly chain, classed among creatures when the soul can flee, and with the sky, the peak, the heaving plain of ocean or the stars, mingle and not in vain. This rural rapture from Byron is quite beside the point. He has only come to terms with nature to the extent that he has befriended his own human nature. The fly likes the sweetness of the honey, but not its stickiness, which makes him a link reluctant in a fleshly chain, classed among creatures. The sentimentalist does not look into the depths of nature and see sluggish existences grazing there, suspended, or slowly crawling close to the bottom, the leaden-eyed shark, the walrus, the turtle, the hairy sea leopard, and the stingray. Passions there, wars, pursuits, tribes, sight in those ocean depths, breathing that thick breathing air. Man has to discover that everything which he beholds in nature, the clammy, foreign-feeling world of the ocean's depths, the wastes of ice, the reptiles of the swamp, the spiders and scorpions, the deserts of lifeless planets, has its counterparts within himself. He is not, then, at one with himself until he realizes that this underside of nature and the feelings of horror which it gives him are also I. For all the qualities which we admire or loathe in the world around us are reflections from within, though from a within that is also a beyond, unconscious, vast, unknown. Our feelings about the crawling world of the wasp's nest and the snake pit are feelings about hidden aspects of our own bodies and brains, and of all their potentialities for unfamiliar creeps and shivers, for unsightly diseases and unimaginable pains. I do not know whether it is true, but it is said that some of the great sages and holy men have an apparently supernatural power over beasts and reptiles, which are always dangerous to ordinary mortals. If this is true, it is certainly because they are able